The Anaheim Ducks won't lose, and the Tampa Bay Lightning are back, and the Hockey Hall of Fame's got a new class in. Sean, there's a lot going on in the hockey world since we last spoke. In fact, the Anaheim Ducks, 8 wins in a row, or 3 podcasts in a row that they have not lost in our last 3 podcasts. How about that?
That's pretty good, because that's a long stretch.
What a story right now. 8 wins in a row. Ryan Getzlaf gets his 1,000th point. The Ducks get their 1,000th win. And Sean, I get home from the Rangers game. We're recording this on Wednesday. And by the way, let's point out, speaking of Anaheim, we're going to have Anaheim Ducks defenseman Cam Fowler join us, and former Anaheim Ducks player and a first-round pick for the Ducks, Emerson Edom, who's now coaching in the backyard of the Anaheim Ducks. You see the Southern California flair to this podcast. He is going to be joining us as well. Emerson Edom is coaching in Tier 3 junior hockey, the Long Beach Shredders. But first, we'll be joined by Cam Fowler. But look, the Ducks, right? 8 wins in a row. Getzlaf with the 1,000th point, like I said. And look, Getzlaf, Sean, he looks like a rejuvenated kid. And I'm watching them last night, late third period overtime. His reactions, they should just ISO cam Ryan Getzlaf from now on, because his reactions to a John Gibson save, to a goal by Trevor Zegras, to a pass, whatever it is, they're like, he just looks younger, fresher, better. His production has been terrific, 18 points. He's got 17 assists this season, but he just looks like he's having a ton of fun. And it's been a while, I think, since Ryan Getzlaf has had this much fun playing hockey.
Well, and it shows, right? That's why he's playing so well, is because he's having fun. And look, the weight of the world's been on him for years. That Anaheim team's really struggled. He came in early and he played on some really good teams. They won the cup. They were good for several years, 100-point teams. Like, you get used to that. And then all of a sudden you're in the hockey wilderness and it's miserable. You go to the rink every day and you're like, what's going to happen today? You know, he had to live through a rebuild. And I think maybe he thought he was going to have to live through more of a rebuild. And then he showed up this year and everybody found it at the same time. You know, he got his mojo back. Troy Terry is the story of the season so far. You know, they've always had John Gibson, and I don't think people realized how good he was, because he would lose all the time because they couldn't score any goals. Now they're scoring a couple of goals for him, and all of a sudden you're looking at John Gibson and you're like, he's one of the 3 best goalies in the league probably. So it's all kind of come together, and to live through that and then find it again is got to be exhilarating.
Yeah, and you mentioned the goals, right? So the Ducks are scoring 3.53 goals per game right now, as we speak, Wednesday morning. That is 3rd in the National Hockey League. You know where they were last season? They were last, 2.21 goals per game. So I don't think 3.5 is going to keep up all year long. That'll probably regress back just a little bit, but they're a better offensive team than they were last year when Max Comtois was their leading scorer and he didn't do very much and they weren't very good at all. And John Gibson was very frustrated. I mean, and rightfully so. He was very frustrated. But now you brought it up, Troy Terry. He's got 21 points in a 15-game point streak. And I agree, he's one of the stories of the season so far. That line with him and Getzlaf and Adam Henrique, you know, has looked very good. I heard somebody say on the radio not long ago that guys like Getzlaf and Henrique needed to take the smelling salts this season. And it was a great line, because it was like, wake up, boys, because if you wake up, maybe the younger guys are going to wake up too. And I don't know if it's the older guys who've woken up the younger guys or if it's the younger guys who've woken up the older guys, but whatever it is, the mix is working right there in Anaheim right now. The question I have, and I think it's the question we ask with a lot of these teams, Sean, teams like the Ducks, the New Jersey Devils, is it sustainable? You know, and I think a hard answer right now, because we haven't seen the Ducks sustain in quite a long time, right? But is Troy Terry sustainable? Is Ryan Getzlaf sustainable? Trevor Zegras scores 2 goals, the overtime goal last night against the Washington Capitals. Is he sustainable in the success that they're having? And I want to say yes, it is, because these guys are young, they're hungry, and they're gaining experience, and they're backed by veterans who've been there and done that. So I want to say, and they're backed by a terrific goaltender. I want to say it is sustainable. What do you think? I mean, is it fair to keep wondering that about Anaheim at this point?
Yeah, it's fair, because they don't have the resume. But I look at this team and Gibson's the backbone. and he covers up a lot of blemishes. And right now they don't have many blemishes, which is why they haven't lost. But I don't know in this league, if you go from not losing for 8 straight games to not being a very good team, like I don't think the swings are that wild. Like you might lose a game, you might lose 2 games, but you know, once you prove that you can win consistently, I don't know that that goes away. So they have a good goaltender. I like their D. You know, we're going to have Cam on. He's been around forever. They got Lindholm. They got Shattenkirk. Like, I think they have a good defense that can help out Gibson. And then, you know, you talked about their offense not being very good. It may regress to the norm, but they have a little bit more wiggle room, right? If you're a top 15 team scoring-wise and you have an elite goalie, that's a far different team than a 32 scoring team with an elite goalie who mm-hmm. pretty much wants to lose his mind because he can't get 2 goals.
100%. And look, in the winning streak, we can talk about all the goals that they're scoring, and they're scoring in this winning streak, no question about it. They've allowed 13 goals in 8 games. So that's probably the underlying reason of why they keep, you know, winning, and the confidence is there to score. Gibson's been good. The defense has been good. So that's a big factor. Let's go back to Getzlaf, though, and I think it's a good transition to what we want to talk about next before we get to our first guest, Cam Fowler. So the Hockey Hall of Fame inductions were Monday night. We saw Jerome Iginla, Marian Hossa, Doug Wilson, Kevin Lowe, Kim St. Pierre, and Ken Holland go in. Ken Holland as a builder, the other 5 as players. Possibles for 2022 include guys like, you know, the Sedin twins and Roberto Luongo and whatnot. Getzlaf's not there yet. Obviously, still playing. Got to retire and be retired for 3 years. Is he a Hall of Famer?
God, yes. Are you going to argue with me about this?
No, I don't.
I hope so, because it'll be fun, but because I'll just trounce you all over the place. But I can't even believe, and I've heard this, you're not the first person that's asked that question. I can't even believe we're having this discussion. He is a first ballot, no questions asked, Hall of Famer. He is the best player on one of the 32 franchises in this league. How does that not qualify as a Hall of Famer? He's the best to ever do it for the Anaheim Ducks. The best to ever do it. He's won internationally. He's won a cup. He can play the game any way you want to play it. He's been a captain forever. He's the fabric of hockey in Anaheim. He is Anaheim. He's the Anaheim Ducks. How is that not Hall of Fame worthy?
He is a Hall of Famer. We're having the discussion because it's a podcast and we need to talk about things like this. But I agree with you. I think it's a slam dunk that he's a Hall of Famer. And you have to factor in his international success too, and how important he has been on the international stage for all those Team Canadas at the Olympics and whatnot and World Championships. He is a guy who has had incredible... You know, I asked the question before, are the Ducks sustainable? He's had incredible sustainability throughout his entire career. At playing, yes, he's a big man, but playing a big man's game for as long as he has too, for one team through the ups and downs of it all. And I think a lot of that has to be said. One team, and he's been a captain for a long time, as you mentioned, but it's the size he's at and the size that he plays at. He even plays a bigger game than he is, and he is a big, big man. So to be able to do that for as long as he has done it, to me, might be the most remarkable thing about Ryan Getzlaf in his career. Then you toss on top of that his leadership, what he means to the franchise, to the community that he plays in, to the international level. You just add layer and layer and layer. I mean, look, Jerome Iginla just went into the Hockey Hall of Fame. He did not play his entire career with one franchise, but he is a Calgary Flame, right? I mean, that's what he's known as. And Jerome Iginla was, for the Calgary Flames, what Ryan Getzlaf has long been for the Anaheim Ducks. And Jerome Iginla was a slam dunk Hall of Famer. He had better numbers, but that's okay. You know, he is a slam dunk Hall of Famer, just as Ryan Getzlaf is. And I agree with you. It shouldn't even be a topic that is debated that much, because this guy has been one of the best players in the National Hockey League for 15 years, if not more.
Jerome Iginla played in Calgary. Ryan Getzlaf plays in Anaheim. there's the difference right there.
Mm-hmm.
But my mom, she always wanted me to be a lawyer. She did not want me to be a hockey podcaster or a writer. So I'm going to put on my lawyer hat for 5 seconds and I'm going to make a closing argument for Ryan Getzlaf right now. And then the case will be decided and we'll move on to who should be in next year.
All right.
These are the players that are active that have scored 1,000 points with one team. Alex Ovechkin, Sidney Crosby, Evgeny Malkin, Patrick Kane, Thornton, and Anze Kopitar. What do they all have in common? They're all going into the Hall of Fame. So is Ryan Getzlaf. Case closed. I win. Who goes in next year, Dan?
You're not going to hear an argument from me. All right. So Henrik Sedin, Daniel Sedin. I think those two guys get in the Hall of Fame next year. You're not going to do one without the other. The Hall of nothing these guys do is one without the other, right? So the Hall of Fame selection committee is going to put both of them in. And they, you know, part of it does go to their international success. Yes, what they have meant to the franchise in Vancouver, playing for one team, first and second all-time scorers in that team. They're the Ryan Getzlafs of the Vancouver Canucks, right? I mean, so they go into the Hall of Fame next year. Carolyn Ouellette, she was mentioned by Kim St. Pierre in her speech. She is a terrific Canadian women's hockey player, 4-time Olympic gold medalist. I'd be shocked if she doesn't go into the Hall of Fame next year. I believe that is her first year of eligibility. And then the question comes, Roberto Luongo. It's harder for goalies, Sean. It's harder for goalies to go into the Hall of Fame on their first year. Luongo's first year is next year. I mean, this guy put up a ton of wins, had a lot of success, international success, very well known. Argue with me if you want about the Sedins and Caroline Ouellette. I'll hear it. But I think the better argument there is Roberto Luongo. I'm 50-50 if he goes in on the first year.
Well, I don't think he goes in on the first year. Just optically, I don't know that that happens. Is Roberto Luongo a Hall of Famer? Yes, he is.
I think so.
He deserves better than what he's gotten recognition-wise. In his own market, that's the scary part, is he's not appreciated in Vancouver.
Right.
As much as he should be for what he did. He was an above average to elite goalie in almost every year of his career, especially in Vancouver. And then you think about what he did for Florida. You think about what he did on the international stage. And look, he grew up at a time when Marty Brodeur was the best goalie there ever was. And he went against them a lot, right? Like, and so he's going to finish second in that argument. When you look at the percentages of who's in the Hall of Fame, goalies are royally screwed. And it's because nobody understands them. Nobody understands the metrics of it. Nobody understands what their jobs are. You know, nobody that's making those selections gets goaltenders. They're kind of a different breed. They don't. And there's that whole for a long time, and it's changed a little bit. Goalies never talked, right? They never spoke because I can't talk to you. It's game day. And then Marty came along and was like, oh, you want to chat for 45 minutes? We'll chat. And you can say what you want, but sports writers have long memories. And when they're not treated the way that they think they should be treated, it's held against that player. And I'm not saying that's the case with Roberto Luongo, but it's certainly the case. And I think with goalies, there's just not as high a profile. You know, I'm the resident goalie union guy on this podcast, and I'll defend them to the ends of the earth. And I think that Roberto Luongo, you know, maybe isn't a first ballot Hall of Famer again because of the class of players that he's going against and some of the politics of it. But he is certainly, without question, a Hall of Famer. But there's guys I would put ahead of him if you want to argue about who should go in. Alexander Mogilny should be in the Hall of Fame without question. We'll go back. Paul Kariya's in the Hall of Fame. Alexander Mogilny's a better player than Paul Kariya was.
Yeah.
He's a better player.
I thought as soon as Paul Kariya went into the Hall of Fame that Mogilny was next. I just kind of had that feeling that it would happen. And it's amazing it hasn't happened yet. He had more points and fewer games and he won the cup. Paul Kariya had less points and more games and didn't win. You know, I mean, it's the comparison you look at. And if Paul Kariya is in the Hall of Fame, then it stands to reason that Alexander Mogilny should be in the Hall of Fame. Maybe his Hall call comes for the class of 22. Here's the thing on Luongo, last part of this for me is he's a Hall of Famer and he should be in as soon as eligible because he's a Hall of Famer and he had a Hall of Fame career and he's fourth all time in wins. He retired third all time in wins, since been passed by Marc-Andre Fleury. If you want to just break it down to the simple facts of what we look at for goaltending, instead of analyzing everything that goalies do and the importance of the position and what they do and, you know, the techniques that they play and the styles and all that and who talks and who doesn't, he won 489 games, fourth all time. He had 77 shutouts, ninth all time. The other guys around him that I'm talking about here, they're all Hall of Famers. Brodeur, Patrick Waugh, Belfour, you know, Terry Sawchuk, Jacques Plante, Tony Esposito, eventually probably Marc-Andre Fleury, eventually probably Henrik Lundqvist, who will probably be the best comparison for Roberto Luongo is Henrik Lundqvist, right? Because, you know, again, franchise icon, won a ton of games, top five all-time in wins or top six all-time in wins, shutouts galore, never won the Stanley Cup, but won on the international stage. That's your best comparison. So if Roberto Luongo is a first ballot Hall of Famer, you know, first year eligibility Hall of Famer, then Henrik Lundqvist should be a first year eligibility Hall of Famer when his time comes. But I think Roberto Luongo should be. He was one of the best goaltenders of his era. And if you're one of the best players at your position in your era, you're a Hall of Famer and you shouldn't have to wait to get in.
And you know who else belongs in the Hall of Fame? And then we'll move on to our interview. Patrick Elias. And that's the Ryan Getzlaf argument. He's the best forward to ever play for the Devils. He holds every record they have. He won two cups with them. He was good with the Czech Republic.
I understand what you're saying about the Ryan Getzlaf argument. The only thing I will say about Patrick Elias, and I wouldn't have any problem if Patrick Elias went into the Hall of Fame, no issue at all, is just the impact in New Jersey that Patrick Elias made is not as big as the impact in Anaheim that Ryan Getzlaf made. But I think that comes to personality too. I think that goes back to personality, to the type of person you are, the player you are. And also remembering that Getzlaf is a Canadian, he's a North American guy, and Patrick Elias is from the Czech Republic. So, you know, I can't imagine the culture shock he felt when he moved to New Jersey from the Czech Republic to play hockey in the NHL. So, but I agree. Hey, I think, you know, he should eventually, but look, if you're going to go for, you know, players next year, former NHL players, it's Henrik Sedin, Daniel Sedin, Roberto Luongo, and Alex McGillney. Those are my four for next year. And then Caroline Ouellette gets in too.
All right. Well, we've settled it. We don't have to have Lanny McDonald doesn't have to have the meetings. We'll just send him a copy of this podcast and Kelly Massey can announce it tomorrow. And I only hope it's as good as this year's class was, as far as celebrating the game and, you know, honoring their past as they went into the Hall of Fame. I thought the speeches were fantastic. And, but before we even get to that, the one thing that maybe shocked me the most from Hall of Fame weekend, and we're on an Anaheim kick, Scott Niedermeyer's beard.
Mm.
He was the captain in the Legends game that they play on Sunday, him and Mike Modano, and big and white.
Yep. He could still skate though.
Oh my God. Can he skate?
And you know who he used to play with? He used to play, I believe he did play some years there with Cam Fowler, who is our guest. He is the Anaheim Ducks defenseman. Let's get to him, Sean. We've talked enough about the Ducks and Getzlaf and the Hall of Fame. So let's hear from the guy who had who scored the goal that helped Ryan Getzlaf get his 1,000th point Tuesday night. Anaheim Ducks defenseman Cam Fowler joined us. Here is that interview. Cam, thanks so much for joining us. Let's get right into it. So we're recording this on Wednesday. Tuesday night was a big night in Anaheim for the Ducks. Getzlaf getting the 1,000th point. You scoring on that one. The 1,000th win. Just describe that, the night, the emotions of the night, and what it was like to have that type of night, you know, in November of a regular season.
Yeah, it was an amazing night. Obviously, all centered around our captain, who has done amazing things for our franchise. So it was nice to see him have such a special milestone, and to be a very small part of that for me was an incredible experience and something I'll remember for a long time. And like you said, you know, it's been a couple hard years in Anaheim, and to have that energy in the building early in the season, playing against a great team, to have some of those special things going on was an incredible night for all of us, and definitely something I'll remember.
So you talk about being a part of history. You're physically going to be a part of that history. Wherever you go, you're going to see that goal. It's going to be a part of Ducks lore forever. Ryan Getzlaff retires. It's going to be there. It's a huge part of the franchise history. Have you thought about the fact that it's going to live forever?
Yeah. You know, now that you mentioned it, that's not really something that has set in for me yet. But, you know, like I said, to be a small part of such an amazing accomplishment for him. He deserves all the credit. Obviously, not many players in this league will hit that milestone. And, you know, to be kind of etched in history there with the Anaheim Ducks along with him is incredibly valuable to me.
So the goal, the moment, it was a small part in a now, what is it, an 8-game winning streak for the Anaheim Ducks. And a start that I don't think a lot of people had predicted, you know, could happen for Anaheim this season, especially with the youth and the questions, are these young guys going to be able to come up and be players? So I guess, what is it about this group right now that's giving way to this success? Why are you guys having the success you're having right now?
Well, I think first and foremost, we have a team that really cares about one another. We have a great kind of blend of veteran leadership with guys that have been around here for a long time, and then mixed in with a lot of youth and guys that bring a lot of energy to the rink and also bring a lot of skill. I mean, you guys have all seen what Zegras can do and Jamie on the back end, and then we have Mac T and Gru, guys who play a hard physical game. So we feel like we have a good blend of players that we really get along, and also the coaching staff that's come in this year has done an amazing job for us. We feel like we're prepared and we're ready to play, especially power play and penalty kill. That's been a big part of our success too, and something that we work really hard on. So it's been nice to see some of our hard work pay off, and we have a long way to go, but it's been a good start for us and hopefully something we can keep going.
You mentioned some of the young guys, and before we get to the headliner who's been stealing all the headlines so far this year, as a defenseman, I wanted you to maybe give me a little bit of a scouting report on Drysdale and what he's been able to do as such a young player. We've talked to a lot of defensemen. They come up so much earlier now, and they're dominant so much earlier. Even then, when you came up, you were kind of one of the guys that started that. Everybody looked and said, wow, look at Cam. He's so young, and he's so ready for the league. The bar is lowered age-wise, where kids are coming up at 20 now and are ready. And Jamie's one of those kids. Can you give me a little bit of a scouting report on why he's so good?
Yeah, well, he's an elite skater, which, as you guys know, the way that the game is trending now, you have to be able to skate and move with the puck and create things offensively. And that's a strength for Jamie. And like you said, there has been a lot of guys recently who have made that step into the league. It's still something that's very challenging and comes with a lot of ups and downs when you're a younger player. And Jamie's somebody who expects a lot out of himself. So I think at times we've had to explain to him, you know, this is a hard league and you're making the jump at 18, 19 years old. Like, there's going to be ups and downs. And he's also been playing against some of the other team's top lines, which took me a long time to be able to do that. So it's really amazing what he's been able to do. And the bar is so high for him, and he'll only continue to get better with experience. And I've been very impressed with what he's done at such a young age.
You know, the guy Sean was talking about there, the guy who's stealing all the headlines, is Troy Terry, right? And it's interesting what you were just saying about Jamie Drysdale as a young guy, you know, ups and downs and whatnot, and you have to kind of work your way to figure it out, different position. But Troy Terry is now one of those older young guys, right? So he's 24 years old. He's been around a little bit, played, and it's like now he's hitting that next stage, that next level of, you know, becoming a player into his prime and what he can do. Did you think that what he's doing now was something that he could do? Was this something that you guys saw, you know, in the past few years, and it's just needed time to come to fruition for him?
Yeah, I think it was clear to me right from the start what he was capable of. I think for our team, he was always someone who, once he kind of got his feet underneath him, he was going to be a top six guy for us and create a lot of offense and play on the power play. I think we'd be lying if we saw this from him and the streak that he's been on, and just incredible for him. And he actually lived with me his first year pro. So I've spent a lot of time with him, and he's become a close friend of mine. And to see kind of all his hard work pay off and him now having the success that I knew that he always could have has been kind of a proud father moment for me. But I always knew it was there with him. I think sometimes with guys like that, they see one or two go in and all of a sudden they get the confidence and then they're off and running. And I think that's been clear to him now what he's capable of doing. And he goes out and plays with confidence and has some great chemistry with Getsy too, which I think helps. And he's been unbelievable for us and a big part of our recent success.
Do you think he's played himself into the Olympic conversation, and has that conversation for you guys started yet in the locker room as you look forward?
Well, I think he's definitely somebody who should be considered. You look at what he's been able to do and his production, and you have to go with guys who are playing their best hockey at the right time. And Troy is showing the world what he can do right now. So I sure hope that he's in consideration. When it comes to the Olympic part, it's not really something that we talk about as a group. We're all focused on the team and what we can do to help the team win. And I think if you're showing that to the people making the decisions at the Olympics, hopefully you can play yourself into a spot on the team. But it's not really something that has come up in the locker room that often.
I wanted to go back to Getzlaff for a second because, whenever I watch you guys, I'm watching a game last night. He's 36 years old. He's been around for it seems like forever now with Anaheim. And his facial expressions, the smile, the jump in his game, it's like he's a kid again, mm-hmm. And certainly success on the ice has something to do with that. But how, what are you seeing from Ryan right now? And am I right in saying, there is a different jump in his step? There's a little jump in his game. And I don't know if it's the young guys that are feeding that to him or if he's feeding that to the young guys, whichever way it is. But do you see it too?
Yeah, no, absolutely. And I think that kind of goes back to what I was talking about with the blend of players that we have. I think there's a lot that these young players can learn from Getz, and anytime he says something, they certainly listen. But the flip side of that is they, they give him some energy. They give him some entertainment at the rink, and the banter in the locker room. I think that's something that Getz has always loved, and I know something he's going to miss dearly when he's done playing. And I think just the energy and the charisma of some of those younger players has given Getz a little extra step. And, I'm a firm believer that he can play until he doesn't want to play anymore. I think the last couple of years have been hard for all of us. And I think it's not fair to use that as an example of what he's capable of. Now he's showing us what he can do even at 36, and he's someone who we rely on in all aspects of the game. And he's showing now that he's capable of doing that just as he has his whole career.
Is he doing like the Tom Brady diet or something that we don't know about?
No, he's not. He's old school. He's there's no secret to what he's doing. He's a competitive guy. And he desperately wants to win. And I think he understands he doesn't have many years left. And I really do believe that he went into this season hoping to have the most fun that he can and soak it all in. And I think he's taking that approach, which has helped him on and off the ice.
How much easier is it now to look John Gibson in the eyes in the locker room that you're scoring 3.5 goals a game as opposed to maybe just a shade over 2 per game?
Yeah, it's a little bit easier for us. Gibby, has been under siege the last couple of years, and As a defenseman, we certainly feel for him. We always go out and do the best we can, but as it was a hard couple of years there, and he was under fire. So now to be able to have a few in the bank now, show him that we can win in different ways, I think helps out a lot, because you know, night in and night out, what he's going to do back there. And there's been a couple nights during this win streak where we wouldn't be here today without him. And that's the story of his career, and one of the reasons why he's top goaltender in the NHL.
He is a top goaltender in the NHL, but he's so underrated. Part of it, obviously, is playing on the West Coast and East Coast. People don't see him as often as maybe others do. I'm curious, you've seen him every day since 2013. What's the foundation of his game? What's the bedrock of why he's so good?
You know, that's a great question. I think, like Getsy, in a lot of ways, he is super competitive. Even in practice, he can't stand getting scored on. You know, he'll even let you know if you get one past him, he'll kind of chirp at you a little bit. He's got that fire in him that he just really believes that nothing should go in on him in a good way. And he's so athletic. You know, there's times where even on the bench or on the ice, I think he might be down and out, and all of a sudden he's on the other side sprawling to make the save. So I really believe that he never feels like he's out of it. And that's what all the best goalies have is they fight till the end, and he's always fighting to make that save for us and comes up huge for us in multiple occasions, night after night. And his consistency too is something that blows me away. He, like I said, every night he makes the big saves for us and keeps us in hockey games. And it's one of the reasons he's so great.
No, he is obviously one of the best in the league. No question about it. So the building was jumping last night though. You know, I mean, it had a vibe. It had some energy. It looked like it was coming through the TV screen, at least to me, and I'm sure you felt it. It's been a while since the building's been jumping there a little bit. What kind of energy is that giving you guys?
Yeah, no, it was a great night. I think there are some Washington fans sprinkled in there too to see Ovechkin, so that helped get some life in the building too. But we've always had amazing fans here in Anaheim, and I think we were feeling the effects of the last few years and some of the struggles that we were going through. So we always want to put the best product on the ice that we can. And the fans have been great for us. And when you get a marquee matchup like that against a great Washington team, the building is going to be going. So, and then obviously with Getsy's point on the line there for the 1,000 and things going on with Troy right now too, and his streak, there were some underlying things there too that helped get a little bit of buzz in the building. So that's a huge advantage for us. We always want to be a team that's hard to play at the Honda Center, and we have been for a while, and it slipped away there the last couple of years, but we always want to protect home ice, and our fans are definitely a big part of that.
You guys have been one of the biggest surprises in the NHL this year. I'm curious, what's one of Cam Fowler's biggest surprises in the NHL this year?
Ooh. That's a good question. I think something that always kind of blows me away is just on any given night, you know, who can beat who. There's the parity in the league is something that, you know, I obviously know as a player, you have to be ready every night, but watching these games, just the skill level that pops out on the screen, I think, some of the younger players who have come in and made such a big impact for a lot of these teams as a fan of hockey is something that I really appreciate, and helping some of these smaller market teams to kind of get on the map, like what Florida's doing and the hockey that they're playing in Carolina. I think it's great for the game, and it's certainly heading in the right direction for the NHL.
All right, Cam, last one from me. You mentioned you lived, or Troy Terry lived with you for a little bit. So you got, what's the lowdown? Is he sloppy? Does he clean up after himself? You know, I mean, does he make his own bed? Come on. You said it was like a father, right?
Yeah. You know, there was definitely a learning curve there. I think his room was kind of his, we didn't go in there very often. I wouldn't say it was the tidiest, but him and Max Jones, actually, he was here as well. And we put them on dish duty after dinner. My wife would cook and put those guys to work in the kitchen. So they did a great job. I think hopefully we helped them grow up a little bit, but they were great to have around the house. I don't have too much dirt on them, but I guess I wouldn't say that they're the tidiest bunch. That's for sure.
You got a little empty nest thing going on there now that they're gone?
I do a little bit. Yeah. We're it's just me and the wife now. So the house isn't as lively as it used to be. There was never a dull moment when those two were in the house. But Scott Niedermeyer and his family took me in when I was a young player. And it was important to my wife that we kind of pay that forward. So it was actually her idea, and talked to Dallas about it, and ended up being a great situation for us. And I hope it helped them to kind of get used to life in the NHL, because it could be really difficult.
Definitely. Well, good job, and keep it up, man. I mean, they're a fun team to watch now, you guys, and the league is taking notice. There's no question about it. So thanks for doing this with us. All right.
Yeah. Thanks, guys. I appreciate it.
All right, Sean, that was good stuff there from Cam Fowler. And I think, look, the Ducks are a story, no question about it. But you know what's also a story? The New Jersey Devils. And I brought them up earlier in the podcast as a team, wondering about sustainability for them. And we'll dive into the mailbag a little bit, my Over the Boards mailbag that runs today on NHL.com. I was asked a question about the Devils and if what we're seeing from them, Sean, is the light at the end of the tunnel from this long rebuild that they've been through. And I want to say yes. That was my answer. It's like, I want to say yes. It certainly looks that way. But again, it comes back to the question of, is what we're seeing for real and sustainable? I think it's real, but I do wonder, can they continue to play at the pace that they play at and continue to, you know, take advantage of teams that way through the course of an 82-game season? Or are they going to hit a lull at some point, which they probably will, and be able to play their way out of that lull? And that's where I'm a little torn in not knowing enough about what I've seen so far from the Devils to say they'll play their way out of the lull. This isn't just a hot start. They'll play their way out of the lull that's coming. I don't know yet. Where do you land on that?
I land that they will. You know, you can talk about a lull, but a lot of this has been built on young legs, and I don't know that they're going to hit a wall. They've done a lot of this without Hughes in the lineup, and you bring him back, and that makes everything a little bit deeper and makes it all work a little bit better. They're better on the back end than they have been, that they wanted to be. I mean, this is the picture of what Fitzgerald, their GM, thought, Tommy Fitzgerald thought would be the finished product. You're seeing it now in the way that they attack, the way that they defend, good goaltending that goes too deep, and that they haven't had. And so to me, it's certainly sustainable. The biggest problem that they have is they're in the group of death, to steal a soccer term. You know, that division is just completely cutthroat. The teams that aren't good in that division right now are the teams that people thought were going to be the best. So if they get better, all of a sudden you're in a lot of trouble. There's just every night's going to be a complete slugfest.
Yeah,
in no trying point. To get points.
Yeah, no, I mean, you're right. The division is just loaded. You got the Pittsburgh Penguins and the New York Islanders, who are seventh and eighth in the division. The Islanders, who have not played a home game yet, you know, they've lost four in a row. They haven't played a home game yet, so that's coming. For them right now, a lot of them after playing 13 straight on the road. And the Penguins just getting Crosby back. They'll ideally eventually get Malkin back. If they can get healthy and get out of, you know, the rut, the early season rut that they're in here, then you got to watch out for them. But that's why I wonder about sustainability for the Devils. That's the biggest reason, you know, is that they play a style that's fast. It's up tempo. It's in your face. It's attack. But can they continue to do that when, assuming teams like the Islanders and the Penguins and the Capitals and, you know, start to, in the Hurricanes, who are already doing it, start to exert their will a little bit on other teams, and they find their games. That's where the sustainability question comes in. But I will say this, and you mentioned their D. Their D is so much better than it's been. And I love the ice time, the breakdown in ice time that Lindy Ruff is giving their sixth defenseman right now is really impressive. Ryan Graves leads the team today as we speak with 2201 per game, ice time per game, right? Last among the six defensemen that play regularly is Jonas Siegenthaler at 1817. So you're not even talking about a 4 minute difference in ice time between one and six. So that tells me that they are balanced on the back end, that they believe in all 60, that they can roll the three pairs. And the additions of Ryan Graves and Dougie Hamilton have just meant a world of difference to the Devils too. But you know, their forwards are playing a certain way that I do wonder, but I don't think their D is going to run out of gas.
And we haven't even mentioned the biggest reason why they're not going to falter, because they have the rookie of the year in Dawson Mercer.
He's been good. Let's slow down on the rookie of the year talk.
Why, who are you going to put ahead of him?
Sider, Raymond.
I don't know. He's in that group. Sure, you could put those guys there, but to me, there's not a fall off. Like, he's got 11 points. He's got 5 goals. Plays on in all situations. Smart. The pass he made the other day to Jesper Bratt for the goal was just out of this world. Look, I'm being a little facetious in anointing him as the rookie of the year, but he's in that conversation and he's not playing like a rookie.
No, he's not. He's been very good. He's third in the league in scoring. By the way, Trevor Zegras as well. You know, he just scored 2 goals, the overtime winner for Anaheim. But anyway,
haven't we given Anaheim enough love, Dan?
There's some more coming. Here's a question for you about the Devils before we get on to the next mailbag question. Jack Hughes comes back. Nico Hischier's there. And Dawson Mercer plays the middle. Does Mercer move to the wing? Or do you just keep it 1-2-3 down the middle?
Keep it 1-2-3 down the middle.
I agree.
Good teams been in this league? They've been three-headed monsters down the middle.
Yeah, I think you keep it down the middle too. All right, next one. Mailbag also got a question about the Pittsburgh Penguins and their goaltending situation. And we saw what Tristan Jarry did in the playoffs last year, and it wasn't very good. The question being, you know, what do you think the Penguins do to address their backup goaltending? And my answer was they go out and try to get Marc-Andre Fleury, and it's not necessarily as a backup. You know, he's pushing Tristan Jarry if they get him. It's just obvious. It's familiarity with number one. Number two, he's gettable because the Chicago Blackhawks don't look like they're going anywhere this season. Fleury's in the last year of a 3-year contract. He's a pending UFA. You know, look, the Blackhawks got him for nothing. Anything they can get for him on a trade market is more than they gave up. So I would ideally think that they'd be looking to do that at some point. But really, for me, it comes down to what are the Penguins going to be? If the Penguins are going to be a 7th and 8th place team come Olympic break, after the Olympic break, then it makes no sense to give up assets to get them. But if the Penguins can give up assets to get them now to help them be a playoff team this season, then I would do it. Or if they're hovering around the playoff berth, you know, in that area come Olympic break and just short after, before the trade deadline, March 21st, then I would do it, because you got Crosby, you got Malkin, you got Letang, and if they're still playing at a high level, you got to do whatever you can to keep winning.
I've heard this 100 times. Has anybody checked in with Marc-Andre Fleury?
You think he wouldn't want to go back to Pittsburgh?
Would you?
Yeah, absolutely. He'd have a chance to play. It's not like he would be going there as a backup. What has Tristan Jarry done to say to, you know what? No, Mark, I'm sorry. You're going to come in and play once every 4 games. You just won the Vezina Trophy last year, and we know how good you can be, but you know, and we know how much the guys here love you, the ones that have been around. But you're going to come in and be the backup. No, why? Why? I mean, Tristan Jarry would have to earn his playing time over Marc-Andre Fleury.
Why would you help that team out? Why would you help him out if you're Marc-Andre Fleury?
I don't know his contract situations. Is there no trade in there? Is there no move in there to where he can block things? That's number one. And number two, I understand where you're going with that. Different regime, though, with Ron Hextall and Brian Burke, number one. Different team. And some of your best friends in hockey are on that team. That's why you'd help them out.
Okay, maybe. Or maybe you're just like, I'm not going to help you out. Like, that's the thing nobody's really talked about is look, people carry grudges. You don't carry a grudge? I don't know what it is, but I know you carry one. It's probably against me and you just won't tell me.
Sometimes.
But look, the Pittsburgh Penguins have 87 other problems to figure out before they get to their goaltending. They scored 1 goal last night against the Buffalo Sabres. Good on the Buffalo Sabres.
They had 46 shots on goal, though.
Yeah, so all isn't right. that a problem?
Or Dustin Tokarski was really good.
Or they were really bad with their shots.
True.
I could take 46 shots in a game and I'm not going to score either. And the one they scored on was a skate that was in the right place at the right time. They did not shoot the puck once last night and beat Dustin Tokarski. Look, and that's a playoff team?
No, not right now. They're in seventh place in the division and they don't look anything like a playoff team right now. I think they're 2-6-2 in their last 10 games.
Yeah, they can't score. That's their problem. They don't have any depth. Evan Rodriguez is being celebrated as a great forward. Again, Evan Rodriguez, nice player. He could do a little bit of everything better than I think maybe people thought he was. Not a top six guy. Not a top six guy on a playoff team.
That's why I said, if they're going to address their goaltending, either you do it right now because it helps your team be better for the duration of the season, or you wait. And if you are not a playoff team, if you are not looking like one, then you don't do it. But if you look like one and you can address the goaltending and other areas, then you do it. So we'll see where it goes. But your point is well taken, Sean. I mean, they are not looking like a playoff team right now. I don't remember. I didn't pick them to make the playoffs. Did you?
Yes.
All right. Well, we'll see. I mean, we'll see. Long way to go. Anyway, let's get to our next guest. And this is in partnership with the NHL Coaches Association. We're happy to catch up with the head coach and owner of the Long Beach Shredders in the U.S. Premier Hockey League and former NHL player and first-round pick, Emerson Edom. So here he is. Emerson, thanks so much for jumping on with us. And look, it's been a while since we caught up with you in the NHL world. Tell us what you're doing now and how did you get into doing this coaching in Long Beach?
Yeah, so I hung him up in the fall of 2018. I was under contract with the Arizona Coyotes and Tucson Runners in 16-17. Didn't quite work out. I moved to Lugano for a short stint. I ended up snagging a PTO with the Kings, Rob Blake, and myself go way back. And when I was 13 years old, I was training with those guys and he just kind of gave me my last shot, which I'm very grateful for. But I ended up having actually a really good camp. It extended into Ontario, but I just knew it was kind of the end after my short stint there. So I hung him up after that. I was working at the Willie Desjardins Academy that fall and winter. So I spent about a year and a little bit more at his South Alberta Hockey Academy out there in Medicine Hat and the surrounding areas. And you know, that allowed me to really log a lot of on ice hours working with young players. And I didn't really understand or know what I was going to do post hockey. I didn't think initially it was going to be coaching, but I felt it was just as rewarding or maybe even more rewarding working with a particular player and seeing where they started at and maybe, you know, a few months to a year later, where they get to. And it just, I mean, essentially, you know, if I could put it into perspective, it's like scoring a goal times 1,000, like it, you know, from a player and coach dynamic, it just, it's so rewarding. Not that I was behind the bench there at the academy, but, you know, just working with these players on ice and really perfecting, you know, me being at the board, in front of these players, me demonstrating and so on and so forth. And, you know, that just really helped me and allowed me to critique what did I need to. And so when I eventually did get back to being on the bench for my first season in Missoula and NA3HL last season, I was that much more prepared. You know, obviously we were all affected by this pandemic, but you know, circumstantially, it felt like we had a great year. And that team in Missoula sold to Rapid City. I felt like I just kept going east and east, and it got colder and colder. And I, you know, for myself and my family, we just want to be closer to family back here in California. So when that team sold, you know, we just kind of said, screw it. We'll purchase our own franchise and bring it back here to Long Beach, our hometown. So it's been great.
What's it been like in the hockey sense of you grew up there, you played there, you played at that very rink where you're playing now. But the landscape of hockey in California has changed in the last 10 years. Pretty much you guys were at the vanguard of it. You were kind of that California gold rush. Now you look at hockey in California and it's completely different. You just look at the league you're playing in. There's what, five California teams on the little circuit that you do in your division?
Yes. So we're one of six teams in the Pacific Division in the USPHL Premier. So in the California teams, you spoke about Lake Tahoe Lakers is a new team. There's a team out in Fresno, the Fresno Monsters. We got ourselves, the Ontario Junior Reign, and the San Diego Sabres. The sixth team is in Las Vegas. So we're one of five California teams. It seems to keep growing. Now we got, both the Ducks and Kings high school leagues, who knows what's next, the sky's the limit for California hockey. Just before we hopped on this call, I was speaking on, in terms of our Pee Wee team, my first Pee Wee AAA team, led by Sandy Gasso, the head coach, who I just saw at a skill session last night, and we talked about the old days and how it kind of compared to the team he's working with now, who's actually the same age. It's a Pee Wee AAA first year age, and back on that first year, my first year, we had myself, Matt Nieto, Bo Bennett, and Jason Zucker, and the thing with the four of us is we just hated to lose against one another, whether we were on a race matched up against one another, whatever the case may be. We were so driven not to lose that we just we hated to lose, and it pushed each other, and that's how we kind of got better, and that's something that Sandy last night mentioned. He also mentioned how quick it was for us to get just the basic fundamentals down, and that was, passing and skating, so on and so forth, that he has to spend that much more time teaching the early fundamentals to his players a lot more than he had to with us. So it's kind of an interesting dynamic.
Emerson, I wanted to go back to something you said earlier, which was really interesting to me. You said when you're working with a player now and you see success, it's like scoring a goal in the NHL times 1,000. So with that in mind, have you found your next passion in your hockey career? Is coaching what you envision yourself doing here for a long time here as a second career in hockey after your playing career? Is now, are you now going to be a coach for a long time?
Oh, 100%. I said, I referenced, kind of what that feeling is of working with a player. It's like scoring a goal. But on the flip side, when you lose, it's like, that one individual on a team after a devastating loss. But for myself, I really feel that pain of 25 at least the roster, the guys playing, 21 guys, I kind of, take that feeling, and on the flip side, a win's the same way. It's like you win 21 times, or that feeling is just 20 times more, just exuberant. And then, on the flip side, losing is the same way. I mean, you're just absolutely crushed. It's both good and bad, but the feeling, it's so rewarding regardless. I just can't really put it in the terms. It's rewarding. To answer your question, I really don't see myself doing anything else. Where this takes me in terms of, levels, moving up and all that, I'm really focused right now on building this brand. If I get a job opportunity or something elsewhere, and I'm happy with kind of where the Long Beach Shredders are at that point, then I'll have to kind of take a look at it. But I'm really just enjoying being in my hometown, continuing to grow the game here in Long Beach. As we mentioned, it's the same ice rink, the rink's liquid ice that I grew up playing here at. And I don't know, it just comes full circle. It's so nice to be home and being able to run this program in front of family and friends. And so I couldn't really ask for much more right now.
Emerson, here's the important question. I was going through, you know, some of the coaches that you played under in your career, and it's a pretty impressive list. Dave Quinn, Willie, you mentioned Trent Yawney, Bruce Boudreau, Alain Vigneault. You played under all those guys. Have you made a phone call to each one of them to apologize now that you're a coach?
You know what? These questions are great. It's interesting to almost look back on maybe some of the excuses you used as a player, or, you know, this coach sucks because of this, and it's all his fault kind of thing, where it's like, wow, you know, if I could look really back and furthermore, the one thing that sticks out in my mind is I remember after a game in Anaheim, I think it was the next morning, where we were rolling out, we were getting ready for just a typical weekday practice. And, you know, I'm all bent out of shape, and I didn't have a good game. I think I, you know, essentially maybe in my mind at the time, was kind of putting the blame a little bit on Bruce, just how it was played, maybe lack of ice time or whatever the case may be. And you know, he straight up showed me the box score sheet that all the players get in the locker rooms after the game. And he said, you know, Emerson, you got donuts across the board. I mean, I literally had zeros, you know, for hits, you know, block shot. I mean, you name it, there was just zeros across the board. And still, even when he showed me, you know, it didn't register. But man, as a coach now looking after it, just your overall impact on the game. It's not a goals and assist standpoint. It's you know, how many hits? Okay, you're not on the score sheet when it comes to popping in a goal or getting an assist. But you know, are you moving your feet? Are you drawing penalties when that stuff's not going on? Are you finishing checks? Are you blocking shots? And that's the one thing, especially at the tier three level, that I really try to have resonate with my guys is, you know, not all of us have this, you know, quote unquote, God given talent. We can go out and make plays shift after shift, like, you know, Marners and the Matthews of the world. It's when you're not doing that, what kind of impact are you having on the game? And I mean, God, you know, to your question, that's one thing that, you know, I look back on a player and I'm like, wow, I mean, he was right in that situation. I kind of use that mentality with my guys. So yeah, it's definitely interesting to see kind of, you know, where you're at as a player, both good and bad, and how that has kind of formulated into a lot of my teachings as a coach.
That leads into my question here is, are you paying attention that much to the NHL game now? I know you're busy, you know, building your program there in Long Beach. Are you paying attention to it? And if you are, does your perspective now as a coach, has it changed your perspective in how you watch the NHL game?
It's kind of interesting. I spend a lot of time. I rarely get to full games anymore with the NHL. Of course, I'll see the big plays. I'll watch highlights, so on and so forth. But I'm really focused on this and where maybe even tier two, and connecting with coaches and making sure that my players are getting the right resources. So of course I got a lot going on, and that certainly have taken in or taken away from how much I've been paying attention to the NHL. But you know, that's not to say that I'm still not keeping in the loop with McDavid's highlight reel goals, you know, what Matthews is doing night in and night out, you know, still those high-end plays that everyone sees that I've been able to, you know, tune into. And speaking on behalf, I was just watching Austin Matthews and Mitch Marner, just some of their clips actually the other day. And it's like, God, and once again, I relay this to my players, you know, I mean, they're up there with the best of them, with being able to play without the puck. You know, they get it, they lose a 50-50 battle, bam, they're moving their feet, trying to get on the inside, try to lift sticks to get that puck right back, just relentless without the puck. And that's, you know, I tell my players the same thing, you know, once again, what's your impact? Are you moving your feet? Are you trying to hound the puck, try to get it back in order to make an impact on the game? But God, whether it's McDavid, whether it's, you know, the highest of high skilled players in the NHL, I mean, boy, are they just wanting those puck touches. And it's fantastic to see.
What is the Ducks being good like they are right now mean for hockey in Anaheim?
I think it means a lot because on paper, it's not like they're an overly fan. You know, I mean, speaking in terms of, okay, you got the likes of Tampa Bay and just on paper, just by eye test, it's like, God, superstar after superstar, and they're not there. And I mean, it's great because I think there was a big question mark on when a lot of these, you know, younger players are going to really, you know, start carrying this franchise. But I mean, it not to say it went, you know, 0 to 100. I think there was progress in the past couple of years in spurts. But, you know, now it's like, whoa, Zegras, you know, and obviously Steele doing what he's doing and at the pace he's doing it. It's like, you know, I'd be curious to see if they even thought that they would, you know, kind of explode like they are this first little stretch. But it's just good to see, you know, a team that probably isn't expected to do very well just based off of paper and where they are at the previous seasons and how it kind of compared to those last teams. You know, kudos to them. I mean, they've figured out an identity, it seemed like. Obviously, you know, they had the unfortunate, circumstances with Bob Murray. They've seemed to kind of have tuned that out and just stuck to what they know. And that's just having fun and playing good. And, just in terms of Bob Murray, you know, he drafted me. I have in my own experiences with Bob, he always treated me right. So I just want to go on the record and saying that, you know, I don't know the circumstances that happened in Anaheim. He gave me my first shot. He was always truthful for me in any which situation, always honest and good to me. So I just want to throw that out there. You know, everyone remembers their first shot, who gave it to him. I want to thank Bob for giving me the shot in Anaheim there. I'll be forever grateful, and I hope he gets the help that, you know, he needs and deserves.
Oh, I think we can all echo that. We all hope he gets the help that he feels he needs, no doubt about it. But I wanted to go back to what you were just saying. You know, so you're talking about Anaheim and the Ducks and success. And I, you know, if the team's successful in your backyard and you're running a program, you know, with kids who are going to watch that team and parents who are going to watch the team and fans, you don't just coach, right? I mean, you got to go out and get sponsorships. You got to recruit. You got to, I mean, there's probably even like web design stuff that you got to be doing, all different, you know, so many different hats. Does success of the NHL team in the market, you know, does that play into the success of your program at all?
Yeah, for sure. I think to best answer your question, we're here to really give the fans cheap entertainment. You know, we're nothing more than a junior team. I didn't want to come out and have just kind of a cliche logo and all this stuff. I've always been a fan of some of these outrageous minor league baseball team names that you hear out in the Midwest and stuff like that. So, A, that's what I wanted to accomplish first. And B, give the community cheap entertainment. You know, we have adults for $11, kids six, so on and so forth. So, bottom line, give the fans something where, you know, every so often, okay, we can't afford a hockey game X amount of times in a month. You know, we can afford to go out to a Shredders game on the odd night. So that's something I wanted to bring to the forefront. But also just presenting something that maybe the NHL isn't doing in a way, just as far as, you know, we have, and just because of the pandemic and certain cleanliness stuff we got to uphold standard wise, you know, we're going to implement a hot tub. You know, I know the Long Beach Ice Dogs, I think the first 50 fans at one point, they had this huge hot tub outside of Long Beach Arena. I think it was made out of like PCP pipe and a big tarp or something. You know, that they made. I just thought it was fantastic. It just kind of is what it is. It was a minor league kind of mentality. So that's what we're going to implement. Once again, once this the protocols for COVID go away, we're going to implement a mechanical bowl right in the front lobby. So we have these plans in place. It's just about, you know, now allowing you know, for the city to kind of start relaxing some of these things so we can get by. But You know, that's what we're trying to bring. We're really trying to not, you know, go overboard. We have right now, currently, we have trash can beer pong being played in between intermission. We got flip cup. We got just we just really, you know, we have cornhole going on in intermission. I mean, we just really just toss it all out there. And, you know, the fans have been loving it so far. So really at a cheaper cost, you know, giving hockey fans something they might not see at the NHL level. So I think it all balances out. That's the way I'm going to put it.
Emerson, before we let you go, I got to ask you one more current events question. We're going to talk about this a lot in the podcast we have already. Ryan Getzlaf becomes the first Duck to get 1,000 points. Tell me your favorite Ryan Getzlaf story.
You know, we were playing, and I wasn't playing very well at the time. You know, we played the Kings in the second round. So it would have been my second year there. So I think 14, so it had been 13, 14 year. I think we played the Kings in the second round, if I'm not mistaken. I was stallmate, so it was Getzlaf in the middle between Corey Perry. We all know his nickname's Worm, so Getzy was in the middle of Worm and myself. There was only three stalls, and he turned over to me. I don't know what period, I can't remember, but he said, you know, Emerson, take jobs here. And, you know, obviously what he meant by that is just like, you know, you're a young guy. He knew I wasn't really playing well. And he was like, you know, go out there, get it done. And obviously in a competitive atmosphere, and we all know sports, you know, guys are competitive and trying to, you know, just make the most of their opportunity. And he turned to me and just said, you know, Emerson, you know, go out and take some jobs out there. And I thought that was really special. I thought it was a personal, you know, a boost where, you know, he was just trying to get me going. But once again, I, you know, for that comment alone, I'll be forever grateful. So that's my favorite Getzy moment. You know, he lives it up. He comes in a new Ferrari probably each and every day, which, you know, who doesn't like to see that, right? I mean, it's that unspoken motivation for a young guy to, you know, come in and you know, for him to be rolling up in a brand new car, I'm just like, you know, I'm going to put in that much more time today to get what he has, and rightfully so. He's worked for everything he has, and no, he's a great leader. You know, obviously this last stretch for what the team he's been a part of is hasn't been easy on him, but hey, look, he's a great guy, great leader, and it's obviously showing here how he's managing these younger guys.
Well, we'll leave it right there. Well said about Getzlaf and everything that you're doing there in Long Beach. So good luck with it, Emerson, and thank you so much for joining us, all right?
Yes, thank you. And just, I'm going to plug it in. Please follow us on Instagram and our other social media platforms. It's at Shredders, USPHL, Shredders, USPHL. So I appreciate it, guys. Thanks so much for having myself, and I look forward to next time.
It was great catching up with Emerson. Fantastic story. That whole California wave that came out when Emerson came out was great. I particularly loved his story at the end about Ryan Getzlaf and the different car every day. I think he's lying about that, but I get the point. And I know Dan, when we're on the road, likes to see what I pull up in each day, but it's usually like a Ford Pinto, which was my first car, by the way. I don't think they make them anymore, but before we get on to more current topics, I need to make a mea culpa for something I said early on. I've been trying to do it for weeks, and we run out of time each week, so I'm putting my foot down now. I'm making the mea culpa. I said, I believe it was the first episode of the year, the first episode before the season started, that Connor McDavid wasn't going to score 100 points this year. I was wrong. I was 100% wrong. He may score 100 points before the All-Star break. God forbid anything happens. Clearly, there has not been a regression. But people mocked me then, and they're going to mock me now because I'm going to make another Connor McDavid point. He's not the best player on his team. Leon Draisaitl's the best player on that team right now.
You had it. You were so close.
I'm not close.
I even was going to pop in and be like, is he going to score 100 points before Leon Draisaitl?
all that, right? Because Leon's got 33 points and Connor's got 29 points right now. And then you have to go there. Connor McDavid is a video game unto himself. He is a player we've never seen before in the National Hockey League. We have never seen a player like this. We've never seen a player play like this before.
Okay.
Connor McDavid is as good as Leon Draisaitl is. To me, still, McDavid's the engine. McDavid's the guy that everybody looks at. There's a goal a couple of nights ago. McDavid has the puck at the top of the zone on the power play, right? Four defenders, four penalty killers are looking at Connor McDavid because they're scared as heck for what he might do. He might go through all of them like he did the New York Rangers, right? It's very possible because he can. Four guys looking directly at Connor McDavid. Leon Draisaitl comes up from the goal line into the right circle. McDavid, knowing that four guys are looking at him, sees Draisaitl, makes the cross pass, you know, the diagonal pass down to the circle, and it's a one-timer into the net. Nobody was focused on Leon Draisaitl. That's a mistake by the defenders. That's a mistake by the PK. Without question, it is. You have to focus on this guy. He's a top player in the NHL. He's the top scorer in the league right now. But McDavid is the engine. McDavid is the guy that takes all of the attention. And when you have a guy on your team that can take all of the attention, the next best player on that team, who is a top five player in the National Hockey League, is also going to look really, really good. But it's McDavid taking on all the attention because McDavid's the best player, not only on his team, he's the best player on the planet right now.
Okay. I guess maybe the Edmonton coach doesn't agree with you.
I don't care.
Who gets the most ice time on that team?
Don't care.
Don't care.
Don't care.
Who plays in all situations?
Look, Connor McDavid plays 22 minutes and 34 seconds per game.
Yep.
Leon plays 30 seconds more than him.
Yep.
30 seconds more. Now, I get it. Leon Draisaitl is having a great season.
He's having a great run. Since he scored 100 points for the first time, there's almost nothing that separates those two players. One scored at 1.6 a game. One scored at 1.4 a game. Draisaitl scored more goals than McDavid. McDavid obviously has more assists than Draisaitl. They've gone back and forth.
Look, the only thing that separates them, Sean, is how the defense looks at them.
Okay.
And oh, by the way, last season, which wasn't that long ago, still this year, right? Connor McDavid scored 21 more points than Leon Draisaitl
and the year
in the same
that,
amount of games.
And the year before that, Draisaitl was better than him. Look, it's an argument
production-wise.
There's an argument to be made, and the fact that it's never even made is ridiculous. And it's because one's German and one's Canadian.
Oh, I wouldn't go there. You might have a point there, but that's not where I'm looking.
No, I'm not saying that's where you're looking. But if those were two Canadians, there would be a bigger argument. Then it would be personal preference. Oh, I like this guy better. I like Bergeron better. I like Barkov better because they play two ways. Or I like this guy better. I like Marchand better because he attacks. Right? You can have those arguments. It's the same thing. Like, is Bergeron better or is Marchand better? Oh, well, you can have that argument. They play the game different way. They're both Canadians. Is Draisaitl better or is McDavid better? McDavid's better.
He is.
Okay. I don't think it's a cut and dried argument.
Okay.
So all I'm going to take my lumps on it again, but at least I made my apology for my first one. 5 weeks from now, we'll revisit this and I'll make my mea culpa for this.
All right. You got it. All right. Let's talk about two teams that would love to have a Connor McDavid or Leon Draisaitl on their team right now. Let's start with the Vancouver Canucks, Sean. So before we get out of here, let's talk about these two teams, the Vancouver Canucks and the New York Islanders. But first, let's go to Vancouver. They're 5-9-2. They just lost 7-1 to Colorado, 7-4 to Vegas, and 5-1 to Anaheim. And no, we're not going to talk anymore about Anaheim. We've done that enough on this podcast. 19-6 in three road games against Colorado, Vegas, and Anaheim. Those are good teams. But I thought Vancouver was going to be a pretty good team. And they're just kind of sleeping, you know? And it really makes me wonder. And I know ownership reportedly met with Jim Benning, the GM. No changes coming. But, I mean, look, they continue down this path, I can't see Travis Green surviving it. And they just gave him an extension.
No, I can't see him surviving it either if they continue down this path. And you talked about those numbers, and Demko's been good, right? That makes it even worse, is that their goalie hasn't been the issue. It's defensive failings. It's the inability to score goals. I mean, they're just a mess, right? Pettersson has done very little this year. And Travis Green talks about how much he cares and how he wants to be better, and he hasn't done it. He didn't do it at the end of last year. He was hurt. You wonder when it's going to come, but they're not good right now. But I think they're going to do anything they can to right the ship as it is now, and not pull the trigger too early on changes. But it's getting harder because the market is getting angry.
The market's angry. You know how angry that market gets in Vancouver.
You don't want to see it go from anger to apathy. And then that's when you have a real problem.
Exactly. They're angry right now. You're not at the apathy point, but they went out this offseason. They got Connor Garland. They got Oliver Ekman-Larsson. I mean, people were looking at those moves and saying, these are good moves for Vancouver. This is the right thing to do. Whether you thought they were ready to win or not, at least they were ready to be a competitive team, top four in that division. And they're not even close right now. And here's another alarming stat for me on the Vancouver Canucks. And the last thing I'll say about them, because I don't want to just keep piling on, they're 87.6% on special teams. Sean, that's 15.3% on the power play and 62.3% on the penalty kill. That adds up to 87.6%. Like that you'd take that for your PK and run with it and wouldn't even factor in the power play. They can't kill a penalty. They don't score power play goals. You're never going to win when you can't kill a penalty and you can't score a power play goal.
No, and that's determination, right? Like you can set up
77.6. My math is terrible.
Oh, see, that's why we're both writers, Dan. Neither one of us can add to save our lives. But
that's worse.
Yeah. And
you wouldn't take that on your PK.
You can have a power play. You can play a diamond, or you can play a diamond in one, or an umbrella, or the guy on the bump, or whatever. Yeah, like there's guys in this league as coaches that make their living doing that. But in the end, you have to have the pieces and you have to have the effort, right? And to me, that's where it's coming in. You know, you talked about Connor Garland. He's been good for them. He's not the problem. They just don't do the simple things well right now. And I don't know where that comes from. But I think when both your power play and your penalty kill aren't good and you have the level of skill you have on your team, there's something happening there.
Yeah, and it doesn't help them at all, by the way, that we're talking about a division, you know, that we've talked about a bunch on this, in this episode here that includes surprising teams like Anaheim, like LA, Calgary. You know, I mean, Vegas isn't even a top four team in that division right now. They're fifth by virtue of games played, you know, as we speak here on Wednesday. So it's getting late early for the Vancouver Canucks. How about the New York Islanders, though? And we'll end with the Islanders today. They're 13 straight games on the road is finally over. I don't want to call it a 13-game road trip because they did go home a bunch during the trip, but they haven't played a home game yet. That comes Saturday against Calgary when they open the new building, UBS Arena. They've lost four in a row. They look like a team in their last four games, especially their last game when they played Tuesday night and lost 6-1 against Florida. That was just done with the road, just done with playing road games. 5-6-2. I think if they were reversed that, like if you were to reverse that 6-5-2, you'd be even more optimistic. Like they won against Florida. You'd be like, okay, all right. They're above 500, in this and that. But now you spin it towards a negative because of how they played. They've lost four in a row and how they finished out, you know, in their 13th straight game. They're minus 10 in goal differential. They don't look like the Islanders. They don't look like the team that we have seen. And we talk about getting late early. Look, I mean, I understand they haven't played a home game yet, but, you know, hey, they're 11 points behind the Flyers and the Rangers. They're 12 points behind, you know, I'm sorry, they're 6 points behind the Flyers. They're 11 behind the Rangers and the Caps, and they're 12 behind Carolina. And they got home games coming up, and they haven't played as many games as those teams, but I think there's you got to hope they win their home games now.
Yeah, and they've got to put together a run. And even at home, that's hard. But look, this isn't your father's Islanders. This isn't even your older brother's Islanders. They're a mess. You know, they lost four games, and you can go on and on all you want about them being on the road. they play in a division where you could go home after every game. Like, that's it's true. The easiest division in the world to play in travel wise. So, and they've been home numerous times and they've had days off. Their last two games were in Florida and they took 36 hours. Like, it's not like they went to California and had to go to Canada all on the same trip. It's been a relatively easy road, to excuse the pun. They've given up more than four goals in each of these games. Their coach is like, I'm not getting what I need from players. There's nobody more honest in this game than Barry Trotz. And mm-hmm. this is a team that should run itself at this point, right? They've been to the Eastern Conference Final 2 years in a row. They know what they need to do. Not a ton's changed. And he's like, I'm not getting what I need. And I need to make changes and people are going to get moved around and people are going to sit down. Not what you expect from a team that's going to the Final Four. They don't look like the Islanders to me. And if I was involved with that team, I would be justifiably nervous. And now the however many Islander people listen to this podcast will dig up all the times that I've slighted the Islanders and talk about my Islander bias and coming out strong. But I think in all brutal honesty, if you ask anybody that's associated with the Islanders, they're nervous right now.
And they should be nervous. Two things I'll say. One, on the positive side, I can totally see the Islanders ripping off a 6-game winning streak, a 7-game winning streak, a 10-game point streak, because that's what we've seen them do the past few years and write this thing right away, as you know, especially when they get the energy of playing some home games it'll just re-energize them, no question about it. But the other thing I'll say, and it's the more alarming thing, is they're slow. This is a fast league. The teams around them are fast. Look at the teams around them, Carolina, the Devils, the Rangers, right? I mean, these are fast teams. The Islanders can't keep up with them right now, especially on the back end. I love Zdeno Chara. He's 44 years old. Like, he can't keep up with them anymore. You know, and he's not playing the most minutes on their back end. So the speed is the thing that really scares me, you know, for the Islanders. I think they can rip off, get re-energized and rip off some wins, but are they going to be able to keep up through the season? Because I just don't see them being able to keep up with some of the teams around them.
Yeah. And how much tread has been taken off that tire with these two runs that they've had. Right. And that's when you see a team, they start to slow down because they just don't have it anymore. Right. And we talk about all the tread wear that's taken off teams that win the cup or get to the cup final. The Islanders are only 6 or 7 games removed from that each year. Like, so they've put some hard time in, and it's really hard in the middle of November to put some urgency into your game when you've been that deep into the playoffs for a couple of years. You keep on saying, it's going to come, we're going to figure it out. And then all of a sudden, you need to win at a 750 clip, right? A percentage clip. And that's hard in this league. If you're the Washington Capitals, if you're the Edmonton Oilers, whichever elite team at the top now, you want to talk about the Carolina Hurricanes, it's hard to run at 750 for an extended period of time.
Yeah, no, it definitely is. But by the time we do this next week, the Islanders will have played 2 home games because we're going to try to record on Tuesday next week. So they'll play home games against Calgary and Toronto. We'll see where they are. But Sean, this was fun. I'm glad we were able to catch up with Cam Fowler and Emerson Edom. And I'll give you one more chance to augment your McDavid Dreisaitl argument right now.
I'm not going to do that. But before I go, I'm just going to say, how awesome was it last night to see Kevin Hayes score?
Yeah.
Right. Raise his hand up for his brother. Like, great moment. And that's the joy of watching hockey, right? Is every week we see those things and there's something that just takes our breath away and says, that's great theater. And that's what it was this week. Good for him. Good for the Hayes family. And what a great note to go out on.
Absolutely. And I'll also add in, I'm not sure what Michael Pezzetta from the Montreal Canadiens was doing, challenging Ryan Reeves to a fight. He did not end well. Normally wouldn't for anybody challenging Ryan Reeves. But anyway, this was a good time. I'm glad we were able to catch up with all the ones we caught up with. And until next week, Sean, keep watching the hockey.